This is the Comics Alternative, the world's smartest comics podcast. Reviews of The Unknown Anti-War Comics, Love and Rockets Volume 4, Number 6, and LaGuardia Numbers 1 and 2. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Comics Alternative. I'm Derek.
And I'm Sturge, and we're two guys with PhDs talking about comics.
And on this week's review episode, we're going to look at three recent or relatively recent releases. We're going to begin with the Unknown Anti-War Comics, published just this week from IDW and Yo Books. After that, we're going to look at the Hernandez Brothers Love and Rockets Volume 4, Issue Number 6, coming out, of course, from Fantagraphics. And then we're going to wrap up with the first two issues of Nnedi Okorafor and Tanya Ford's LaGuardia, which is a Dark Horse release from the Berger Books imprint. But before we get to that discussion, we want to let all of you know that this episode of the Comics Alternative is brought to you by the great folks at Discount Comic Book Service. Go to their website, dcbservice.com, for all of your comics pre-ordering needs. There, you're going to find all DC, Marvel, Image, and Dark Horse titles at 40% off of the cover price if you pre-order. For all of the other publishers, you'll find that those discounts can be anywhere from 20 to 35% off of the cover price, and every single month you're going to find some incredible specials. Sometimes those specials could be as much as 45% off of the cover price, sometimes 50% off cover, but every now and again you can find discounts that are even more impressive than that.
That's right, Derek. And if you look now, pretty much the entire Love and Rockets catalog is available for 35% off. And the fourth issue of LaGuardia, which culminates the series, is available for 40% off.
That's right. You know, especially if you're not really familiar with the world of Love and Rockets, and you may get a little lost with what Sturge and I are talking about later in the show, then this would be a great way for you to get caught up and to learn the worlds of Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez. But whatever comics you get, if you get them at Discount Comic Book Service, you can't go wrong. Go to dcbservice.com because they will take care of all of your comics pre-ordering needs. And after you do get your titles there, please be sure to send them an email and tell them that the two guys with PhDs sent you.
That's right.
And save some coin.
So say cash money.
That's right. Sturge, before we plunge into this week's episode, I want to share something that I recently noticed.
Mail time.
Ooh, the mail's here. That means we get to see our old friend, Mailbox.
And the way that I worded it, I said something that I recently noticed, not a message or an email that we recently got. And what I mean by that is over the holiday season, I don't know, I was looking through our Twitter account and I noticed that under messages that there were several that we had received that were, I guess, listed under the request tab as opposed to the inbox tab. Now, I didn't know that Twitter did this. I thought that you could only direct message someone if you followed them and they followed you, right?
Right.
Now, if there is this mutual following, then you get alerted that you have a new direct message. But when someone you don't follow sends you a direct message, which I wasn't even sure you could do until just last month, then those messages go into, I guess, a request area, and you're not alerted to this. In other words, I've gotten no indication that we got these messages, these direct messages on Twitter. And so I clicked the request tab that I really hadn't noticed before, and I saw that we had gotten over the past year a number of these direct messages from people that the Comics Alternative Twitter account does not follow. Now, all but one were really, hey, how you doing? You may be interested in a new comic that we have. And I appreciate people reaching out about the work that they're doing. You know, it's not often that someone will contact us and we'll have the occasion to discuss their self-published work on the show. Sometimes we have. I wasn't so much moved by that one as a message that we actually received back in February 2018, and I didn't see until a couple of weeks ago. And this is from Raul Martin, and he writes, or he wrote, past tense, last year, "Hi, Derek. I'm a Spanish podcaster who has discovered your podcast while searching English podcasts in order to practice my listening English. I just want to tell you that the Comics Alternative is the best foreign podcast I have ever discovered in a year of looking for them. And that's all. Many thanks for your efforts and your working. Congratulations, and sorry about my clumsy English." And again, this is from Raul Martin, and he is at RAU1MARTIN on Twitter. And when I saw this message, I was moved. He said that he thought that it was the best foreign podcast that he had listened to. So thank you, Raul. We appreciate that. So again, a couple of 3 weeks ago, I messaged him back and said, I started to follow him, but then I said, sorry, I didn't see this until just the other day. I appreciate the kind words. And then he responded almost immediately back to me. He said, "Thanks for your reply, Derek. The name of," because I asked him about the name of his podcast. He said, "The name of my podcast is Extraños en el Paraíso," or translates into Strangers in Paradise. "Hmm. We named it after the book of Terry Moore, but also for the symbolism it contains." And then he provided a link. And in fact, if you do, dear listener, a search for Raul's podcast, put in Extraños en el Paraíso, Strangers in Paradise in Spanish. And then he concludes his last message. "Many thanks once more for contacting me and congratulations for your show. I can assure you that thanks to Comics Alternative, I discovered comics such as My Favorite Thing is Monsters, Sabrina, and Snagglepuss."
Oh, cool. That's really cool. That's really flattering. And I'm excited to hear that you've been we've been such an inspiration. Well, more so you than me, probably, because you've got the body of work more so than I do.
Yeah. I wish I understood Spanish. I don't speak it. I don't really understand it much at all. And so, Raul, I'm sorry that I can't listen to and get anything out of your podcast like you've gotten out of the Comics Alternative, but very much thank you for getting in contact with us. I'm just sorry that I didn't even see this message until late December.
Hey, that happens to me all the time. I don't know how half of these things work, which is horrible for me to admit, but you get messages and they're there, but they're not there.
Yeah. Well, the thing that struck me is if we get any kind of message, direct message, whether it be from someone who follows us or not, you'd think that there'd be some kind of alert, but there's not. And I'm not talking about an email alert. I'm talking about within the platform of Twitter, whether it be an app or a desktop version. Or the website version. No indication whatsoever. So I think that's one of the little glitches in that social networking platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed it. I mean, I haven't noticed it with Twitter as much, but I have had it happen there. But the Facebook, I went through once and I was like, I found all these things from people I had no idea had sent me anything. They all probably just think I'm rude.
Yeah. God, don't get me started on Facebook.
Hey, I keep thinking about just deleting it.
Well, on a much more positive note,
hey!
Let's get into the titles that we're going to be discussing this week. And we're going to begin with a book that just this week came out from mm-hmm. IDW and Yo Books. And this is something that our friend Craig Yo talked with me a little bit about when I interviewed him for our annual Happy New Yo show at the very beginning of the year. And this is the collection, The Unknown Anti-War Comics. And the official release date on this is actually the day as we're recording this, January 8th.
Yeah. Wow. That's, think of it as a a good follow-up because, I don't know, I didn't get a chance to talk to him. So at least I get to talk about one of his books and he can listen, hopefully. Yes. And that'll be fun for me.
Right. And, you know, this is a really nice collection. It's the kind of things that we've come to expect from Yo Books. Mm-hmm. And so what Craig and his spouse, co-worker, Clitia, have done is to go through and cull a variety of anti-war comics from, it seems to me, what, about the 1950s and 60s,
mm-hmm.
primarily. Late 1950s, and I guess going into the 1960s.
Yeah, some of them are in the 60s.
Yeah, and all of them are from Charlton titles, mm-hmm. and which is something that Craig points out in his introduction.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I mean, one of the things I love about Craig's work in general is that he goes and finds things that he reads a wide variety of things, and he kind of figures out like the little hidden gems and things that you might overlook or just stuff that I wasn't aware of at all. Like I had no idea Charlton even did these kinds of comics. And I was really impressed reading through, you know, I'm not going to say every one of them was exemplary, but a lot of them were very interesting and thought provoking. There's a couple that are a little, you could see like the formula. I think a couple of them have the same name. What was it? Like in a row. I laughed about it. Cause it was like, oh, what was it? I'm going to find that. The Enemy. So like, there's a whole bunch that were like The Enemy. And I was like, oh, okay. So you had a formula. And they kind of have the same plot almost. But they were really, you know, one was from 63 and one was from, what was the other? Followed up by Man's Best Friend.
Mm-hmm.
And one was with 61, which so it was like 2 years apart. And I was like, okay. So you saw that Twilight Zone. I don't know. That was my horrible take on those two. But for the most part, I really enjoyed, I don't know, the variety of things. And I had no idea. I mean, I know Ditko did work for them, but, you know, I associate him more with Marvel, and I'm way more familiar with his Marvel stuff than his Charlton stuff.
Right. Yeah, he did a lot for Charlton. And in fact, that's one of the things that Craig really plays up mm-hmm. in this collection. And in fact, you can see on the cover, he even mentions featuring the art of Steve Ditko of Spider-Man, as if someone didn't know who Steve Ditko was
when
he picked up this book. But yeah, so, you know, Ditko doesn't do the art on all or even of most of these comics, but especially as we get toward the back of the collection, we see a whole string of these Charlton stories that have a kind of anti-war feel that Steve Ditko illustrated.
Yeah, and I don't know, I'm more familiar with like the Captain Atom and the Blue Beetle and those kinds of things that I know he did. So reading these was, I mean, his art's gorgeous mm-hmm. in its way. And I just really liked seeing those. He saved them for the end too, which we could talk about how this thing is arranged, but I was, you know, Ditko's name is front and center. And then he's like, well, okay, we're going to put him towards the back. So you're not going to get to his stories until, you know, you've kind of poured through everything else.
Right. Now, one of the things that Craig does at the very beginning in his introduction, and we should mention that this collection actually has a couple of intros from creators other than Craig. And in fact, I was really impressed that Craig got Nate Powell to do a one-page comic about his discovery of an anti-war comic, The Nom, when he was growing up. And how it kind of opened his eyes to things. And then we have another introduction by Noel Paul Stuckey of Peter, Paul, and Mary, who talks about the anti-war movement and the significance of anti-war cartoonists. And he mentions, among others, Walt Kelly in that pantheon. And then the thing that is so notable about Craig's introduction, and this is similar to something that we saw in his collection from last year, Super Patriotic Heroes. And I know you commented on this as well, and I think I talked with him about it. He goes through in the introduction to that collection a whole slew of titles mm-hmm. that had Patriot or Captain or General in one form or another, and the sheer number of titles that had a kind of soldier or patriotic tone to it was just staggering. And he does something similar here in his introduction of the Unknown Anti-War comics, where he says that a lot of comics, both during and especially after the Second World War, had a kind of, in many ways, a nationalistic, almost pro-war, kind of aggressive and conservative stance. And he goes through this whole list of titles such as Exciting War, War Heroes, War Comics, War Battles, War Fury, This Is War, War Report, War Victory Comics, Outstanding American Heroes, War Stories, War Combat, War Action, War Adventure, True War Experiences, Fighting War Stories, War Fury, Water, War Front, and Atomic War, that included an exclamation mark. But and that's not all. I mean, he goes on for another couple of paragraphs about other titles that had war or fighting in the name of the comic in one form or another, or combat. So, I mean, it's just amazing how many war comics he goes through just listing in this introduction. But he does so as a way of setting a context for the comics that are collected in the Unknown Anti-War stories or comics, in that these are unknown. In other words, they first off, they appeared in Charlton Publications, and even though they had, I guess, a large enough circulation during the 50s and 60s, not near as well known as some of the larger publishers, obviously, as DC or Marvel. These comics or these stories may have fallen out of memory from many readers. And so that's the purpose behind this. And Craig, as we get in the brief bio at the very end of this introduction, is no stranger to anti-war activism.
Yeah. And I was actually kind of surprised also in the introduction to learn that there was a U.S. government writers war board that actually talked to the comics publishers and had, seems like, a pretty strong hand in kind of dictating what the tone of the stories and the content of the stories. And they kind of wanted anti, you know, Japanese and anti-German, more of that stuff, and really strong propaganda images. So that, to me, I always, I don't know, in my mind, it's always one of those things that I think of, you know, like these publishers were just patriotic, or they had a strong opinion about the war, so they put out these stories, and it was like creative, and it wasn't all that way. You know, there was a strong influence from the government, which I had no awareness of that. So I really appreciated reading that and thinking about, I don't know, I think about especially the depiction of Asians and how they looked. I mean, they're usually monstrous and horribly colored, and, you know, look like, like werewolves or something like that. So that, to me, was, you know, I appreciated Craig setting up all this context to kind of talk about these stories, because they are surprising, like you said, because they're not nationalistic in the way that typical comics, I think, were. And I thought about, did you read The Question, the series that it was in the 80s that Denny O'Neill wrote?
You mean the
superhero?
The character, the DC character.
The DC character, The Question, yeah.
I've read a number of Question comics, but I can't remember if that's one of them that I read, that run that I read.
I just remember because one of the things that kind of came to my head talking about this is that there's an issue where he runs into a, like, a World War II Golden Age comics artist who sits there and talks about how he won the war for the Allied side. And he did it by creating totems, basically, through the comics that altered reality and made that happen. And so the way he kind of talks about it is that the power of narrative is such that it affects reality. And if enough people on our side did anti-German comics, then we would defeat Germany just by power of the narrative being created. And he's like, I did that.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you don't think of, you know, artists winning wars, but, you know, I think, I don't know, all of that's just kind of swimming around in my head. And there's a Denny O'Neill story that closes out this book too. So I think that's just, I don't know, it's just what's been swimming around in my brain as I kind of go through this and think about, you know, that art influencing reality, or, you know, trying to create mindsets. And, you know, and I thought a lot about, and I know Craig mentions this too. I mean, you know, the Harvey Kurtzman, you know, the famous war comics he did for EC Comics.
Right. Two-Fisted Tales and Frontline Combat.
Right. And how basically, and I never really thought about them because I read a lot about those too. But, you know, I kind of liked Craig's analysis that, well, basically it just says, okay, well, killing's bad. That's why war is bad. And it's not about the other things, the other nuances of it, which I thought was also interesting to me. What kind of struck me about the Charlton books is that love is like the thing in here. You know, I felt like a flashback to our Beatles episode, but you know, it's like, love is all we need. You know, like that's like the, you know, that's usually, I'm not saying, you know, they're not all formulaic, but at the end, it's always like love is the thing that will create, you know, keep us together. Love is the thing that will save us. Love is the thing that will bring us together.
It's not a Captain and Tennille song.
I was just thinking that too. I know it will keep us together. He just RIP Captain. He just, I think, passed away last week.
Oh, really?
I know.
So we lost Ditko last year. We lost the Captain.
That's right.
Just a few days ago. I didn't know that. But yeah, in fact, one story that is, I think, rather formulaic that drives home that point about love is the short story. This begins on page 58 of the collection called The Ultimate Weapon. Mm-hmm. And basically we have an alien force that comes down and starts destroying Earth, and all seems lost except when a minister, priest, preacher, we don't know exactly, a religious man, or a man of some kind of cloth.
A non-denominational figure.
Yes, exactly. And he gets down and it looks like he's praying, and one of the alien rays hits him, but nothing happens to him because he was preaching about love, we find out later. And so then the aliens are frustrated that their weapons are becoming useless now because there's some kind of force that at first they can't identify that's stifling their efforts. And then as they leave, they realize and actually give name to this new force that they can't get around on Earth called love.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, it's kind of cheesy. But on the other, I mean, it does have, I guess, rather an overt anti-war message. And something that you said about the formulaic nature of many of these stories. Yeah, I'd even say that many of them are a little on the cheesy side. But you have to read them within their context, within their time. I mean, it's easy to look back at some of these older comics and to poke fun at them. But I think that at what they're attempting to do, they're quite successful. Now, keep this in mind because I want to come back to this idea about being political and timely when it comes to certain issues, political issues, social issues, when we get to our discussion later in the show of issues 1 and 2 of LaGuardia. Okay. I do want to come back to that. But something that you said earlier, the anti-war comics of Harvey Kurtzman and his EC work, you know, you're right, and I'm glad that Craig pointed this out. Usually when you hear about anti-war comics, especially in the 1950s and 60s, 70s get a little different, a name that almost everyone comes up with in terms of referencing anti-war comics or comics that have an anti-war feel to them of some sort is Harvey Kurtzman and his right. Two-Fisted Tales, his Frontline Comics, Combat Comics. But one of the things that, as you mentioned, Craig points out is that they're not so much anti-war as pro-human, right? And so if war kills humans and takes away our humanity, then we should keep it in guard. In other words, the way that Craig describes it, the Kurtzman position is that at times it may be necessary. That doesn't necessarily make it right, but we need to do the duty, right? We need to fight the good fight. Whereas the stories in this collection, again, these comics that originally appeared in Charlton titles in the 1950s and 60s, have a more aggressive and I think non-tempered anti-war stance.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. And I think they make an attempt to make it more international and not America specific. Like right. A lot of them are kind of like, you know, a couple of them kind of remind me of that Outer Limits episode that Watchmen rips off, where the aliens just kind of make up a ploy to make all of the Earth people band together to kind of face a common threat. But the aliens in this comic, where is that one? It's the one about the...
The Grand Canyon?
Exactly, the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, the night the Grand Canyon disappeared.
That's right, on page 55, where the aliens are, you know, well-meaning, so they just say, okay, we're going to put this stuff in the Grand Canyon. It looks like ice, but it's... Or it looks like glass, but it's metal. And then we'll send this message saying, you know... And then all the countries... Actually, they don't send a message at all, but all the world just decides to send messages. You know, all our scientists, they have to be taken off atomic bomb research, and they naft and all go to Colorado, which it's in Arizona. But that's a typo. but they have to go there and, you know, study this thing. And then they all kind of band together because there's a common threat. And the aliens know this, and they say, you know, okay, they look Lex Luthor-ish to me, the aliens. They're these bald fellas wearing capes with little atomic symbols on their chests. But, you know, they're there and they say, okay, we tried to contact them directly, but instead, you know, we will do this secret method. They don't say that we will do this secret method, but this is basically a ploy. And you know what actually gets me about these stories is that this thing we just described is three pages long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of these comics are very short.
Oh, yeah. But decompressed. It's like that a lot happens in here.
Right.
And, you know, and you know, you talk about representation before, too. You know, like there's in that comic particularly, there's that kind of on the second page, there's, you know, there's lots of people with beards. It looks like a miner. And then there's like this big, you know, he's international. I think everyone's white, but the guy's international because he's got a turban.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, a lot of people smoking pipes in this book in general.
Right. And one character that the turbaned man is speaking to uses the word chaps. Oh, so, yeah. You know, he's English and not American, or at least from some country that has English roots to it in some form or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Capital, old chap.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you know, a moment ago you mentioned The Outer Limits, and then earlier you referenced The Twilight Zone. A lot of these stories do have a Twilight Zone or Outer Limits tone to them, and this comes through most notably with the anti-war stories that use science fiction as a backdrop, right, that employ the various conventions of that genre. And I think a lot of these stories are like this. And one of the benefits of using science fiction in this way is that it allows the writer or the writers. And as Craig points out, the writer of the majority of these stories is probably Joe Gill,
mm-hmm,
you know,
right,
who, you know, really made his name primarily with Charlton, was a very active writer. And, you know, one of the most prolific creators, writers, and comics. And even though he's not credited with writing these stories, you know, Craig tends to believe that the majority of these were written by Gill. And so the way that Gill and perhaps others utilize science fiction is a way of not necessarily anchoring this in anything too politically or temporally specific, right? You know, you mentioned the international feel of many of these comics as opposed to, let's say, a lot of the Kurtzman stories that appeared in EC titles that may have had more of an American, not all the time, but maybe for the most part had an American focus to it. Mm-hmm. Here, there's more of an international feel, and I think that is enhanced by the fact that many of these stories fall within what you could consider either, I don't know, a science fiction genre or something that is similarly fantastical.
Yeah, yeah, and the majority of them are, you know, there's aliens and things like that. I mean, so what struck me about at the beginning, one of my favorite ones in this story, in this book, is on page 44, Two Men in the Sky, which kind of felt like an Enemy Ace ripoff in a way, but not in a bad way. But is this kind of like if we want to talk about a comic and it being fair and balanced, like this is like the fair and balanced comic where – you know, I think it's World War. Yeah, it's World War One, set in 1918. At first, you know, the first half of it is a portrait of, you know, this noble American. I think he's American. Yeah, he's American. Yep.
He's from Dayton.
That's right, from Dayton. Good old Dayton. He's a fighter pilot, and he's going through all the reasons why, you know, why he's fighting. He's thinking about his family. He's thinking about his country. But he's also thinking, like, you know, why do we have to have war? Why do we have to do these things? And
I just want to be home with my family.
Exactly. And then it cuts to, you know, another scene where it's the same thing, basically, except for with the German pilot. He's thinking the same things.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And their names are even similar. Yeah. Their names are similar. The American is Harry Smith, and mm-hmm. the German is Hans Schmidt.
That's right. See? And I like it. I mean, there's a part of me that thinks that you could look at this as kind of like ham-handed, like, you know, like, we're going to set this up and set this up. But I think they pull it off with this story. I actually thought it was quite moving because they're, you know, they're both kind of talking about how human they are and why they're doing what they're doing. And then it kind of ends, you know, you don't get the resolution at the end because they're just going to say, okay, one of you has to die and maybe both of you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I really like that one.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned this because I have to tell you, one of my favorite parts of this book, or some of my favorite stories, actually are at the very beginning. And mm-hmm. as Craig mentions in his intro, He opens the book with a couple of issues, or the two issues that Charlton published of the title of the series, or the two issue series, was Never Again. Yeah. And he speculates that these are anti-war comics that were probably written years before, but had just never been published. But then Charlton got their hands on it and thought, hey, this is content that we can run our presses with, so let's put this out. And so the title, Never Again, we have it's weird because there are two issues that are included here. I'm assuming that they're the complete issues. I don't know. But the first issue of Never Again, we even have the cover with art by Ross Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
And this is issue number one. Now, curiously enough, the second issue of Never Again is numbered number 8. Why? I don't know. But another thing that kind of combines these stories that make up the first, 50-some pages of this book, they're Never Again stories, the first two issues of Never Again, and everything is framed by kind of a ghostly host, right? And this host is the unknown soldier. And so for all of these stories, including the one that you were just describing, right, mm-hmm. with the pilots, the unknown soldier is – and he's drawn as a doughboy from World War I,
right.
is the one who narrates these stories. And so after we get his introduction, we get the first story proper, which actually takes place in the 18th – or the 19th century in the American West, the beginning of the end. And so we have the trials of one of the last, I guess, as it's described here, fighting chiefs called, what is it, Chief Joseph, he's called?
Right. Yeah.
In his last stand, so to speak. Then there is a narrated story where the unknown soldier introduces a tale that takes place during the Hundred Years' War, and this story is called Battle of the Bows. And then we get, beginning with this second issue of Never Again, number 8, the story, which is kind of long, about an American naval officer, and this story is called Career Man.
Right.
And then after that, we get the story that you referenced earlier, Two Men in the Sky. So I really did enjoy these stories. I think that they were well written. But mm-hmm. the thing that I appreciated most about them, I think, is the fact that we had this host, the unknown soldier, who introduced the stories and made comments about them. And the reason I liked it is it reminded me of some of the things we used to get in not only EC comics, obviously, you know, with right. the Crypt Keeper, the Witch, and so on and so forth. But we even got into the 1970s with titles from, let's say, DC, such as House of Mystery, House of Secrets, and in a comedic sense, Plop. This is the second week in a row we've referenced Plop.
I love it.
Yeah.
Or Ploptastic. How's that?
There you go. Ploptastic. There's a subtitle for this week's show.
That's right.
Yeah. But yeah, I really enjoyed those Never Again stories that opened this collection.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think they're the strongest in terms of the story, and anyway. And I do, you know, like that number eight is kind of a curious thing. I just have them, they're sitting around like, okay, make it number two. Well, then if they feel like they missed number one, they might not buy number two. It's like, well, how long do you have to go in before you buy that issue, you know, without buying all the other issues? Eight. You know, like they just said, let's make it eight. But yeah, and I like those, and I'm glad you brought up career, or you mentioned Career Man too, because that was one of my favorites too. The kind of you know, John Hutch Hutchinson, the career naval officer who's been in for like 40 years, because every time, you know, it's like time for him to get out, like the timings where he's like, well, there's a conflict, and if I'm here, you know, I'm like a seasoned hand, and I'll be here, and I can help make the world safe. And it's like, you know, like there's just war after war after war. And like the young kind of sailors are like, no more wars. You know, like they're kind of hopeful that nuclear energy or atomic weapons will make it so that no one will fight anymore. So that's kind of a weird, hopeful note to end a story with.
Well, you're right. I mean, but this is part of the logic that we got during the Cold War, right?
Sure.
That the buildup of weapons then will make it prohibitive because no one would want to start anything with so many destructive weapons in the arsenal. And in fact, this becomes the narrative centerpiece, the keystone, if you will,
right,
to the very last story in this collection, which I guess was an entire issue, Children of Doom. And this was in the Charlton Premiere series, I guess.
Right.
Issue number two of Charlton Premiere. And this is the one that I think you referenced earlier. You said that Denny O'Neill is one of the writers, although he goes by the name Sergius O'Shaughnessy.
You couldn't moonlight back then. You got in trouble if you were like, you're publishing for Charlton, then you're out.
Yeah.
Marvel or DC, whoever had him at the moment.
But yeah, and the thing I enjoy, this is another one that I particularly liked in this collection. And it ends the volume. And one of the reasons I liked it, because I thought that the writing was pretty strong, but at the same time, I appreciated the length, right? So this is a story that takes up what seemed to be an entire issue of Charlton Premiere, and it's in three parts. So we have like a three-act play here.
Yeah. And from the introduction too, I think that this is one of those books. This is, you know, I'm not trying to take anything away from Charlton, because I think it was, you know, I think a very interesting and unique publisher. But you know, I think the perception, at least, you know, you mentioned before, like, we make comics because we need to keep the presses going all the time. And, you know, there's that kind of, there's always was that kind of, I think Charlton always had that optic of like, being the RC Cola of like comic books. Like it's not the big two, you know, it might not be the big three, but it's there, it's solid, it's, you know, and I like RC Cola. This is not to discount RC Cola. I'm just talking about market share and size of you know, awareness.
It's not Coke, it's not Pepsi, it's not even Shasta.
That's right.
It's RC.
That's right. And you know, the work is all good. And sometimes it's great, but it's not, you know, it's the knock on them is that the art is never really that strong, you know, and the lettering is, I always think, especially from the earlier stories, you know, lettering is basically like typeset, not hand lettered. So it kind of reminds me of like EC stuff in a way, just from the, you know, that visual, but you know, it's like, I don't know. The knock on them is that they always cut corners. Like they're not paying for the best artist. They're not paying for the, you know, it's kind of like Marvel, I guess, when it was Atlas and Stanley was writing everything and spread thin, like Joe Gill was that guy for them.
Yeah. Well, and also Charlton had the reputation of paying one of the lowest rates in the industry.
Right. Exactly. And they just kind of got lucky once in a while because Ditko wanted to work for him, or, you know, Dick Giordano or Denny O'Neill would do things. And, you know, I'm not saying, you know, just like they got lucky, because some of the work in here is really strong. It's just, it's uneven. This is how I guess I'll put it. You know, I'm not saying that I didn't enjoy it either, because they're fun and they're definitely new for me. They kind of reminded me also of kind of like the similar time period or more Silver Age DC stuff, like their kind of Strange Adventures and those kinds of sci-fi stories that they had. they were really similar, and you know, not for their anti-war stance, because I think that's kind of unique to the Charlton thing, but kind of the sci-fi flavor of them. I don't know if you've read many of those. I've read. I'm not going to say I'm an expert on them either, but I've read a few of those, and they kind of run similar for me.
Yeah. Now you mentioned Ditko again as the artist of many of these, and I think that his run begins, if I'm not mistaken, on page 160 with the story "Stranger in the House."
Right.
And then there's a whole series of Ditko penned comics. And even if you didn't know, if Ditko's name wasn't associated at the bottom of the page, the first page of each of these stories, you could look at the art and say, Ditko.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's well, he's distinctive. And it's not even like there's a lot of wonky fingers or a lot of wonky hands. It's distinctive for other reasons.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I didn't want to shortchange the talk of Children of Doom, because I also agree with you. I think that's like one of the strongest pieces in this book, and I think the art by Pat Boyette is very attractive in a way that, and it kind of stands out from the rest of the book. Not that the style is not the same as Ditko, but I think it's similarly well laid out and interesting, and I like that it plays with kind of black and white and grays and going into color. And you know, from the introduction, I had no idea that this story existed, but apparently this is like a favorite for many comics creators or many people.
Alan
who read
Moore,
comics.
Apparently, according to Craig and his introduction.
Yeah, so I was glad to read that, because I had no idea that this even existed, and apparently it's a classic of the, you know, from the time, and I really enjoyed reading that and seeing all these. I don't know. It's kind of a crazy story in a lot of ways, with time travel and aliens and
yeah, it's all over the place.
Yeah,
in many ways. I don't know. One of my favorite parts of Children of Doom. This is on page 216, and this is the very end of part two.
Yeah.
Of the story, and it. Because of the two astronauts who go to Venus because they think the Earth is destroyed, then get word that, well, there actually are people still living on Earth. They go back, and as they're landing, they use some kind of nuclear-powered booster, which sets off this doomsday machine. And so they think that the Earth is going to be, this time, very much destroyed. And one of the astronauts, I guess it's Joe, says to his colleague Hank, you know, that they should get out. You know, at least they can save their own skin. And then Hank hits Joe crack across the jaw and says, you know, we can't do that. You know, we're the ones who caused this. Anyway, if everyone else is dead, what's the sense in our staying alive?
That's some drama right there.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of over-the-top drama, especially when Hank whacks Joe in the head.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, it's fun.
Oh, yeah. And I love, I don't know, the look of them. You know, they're all scraggly. You can tell that they've been astronauts. They're like out and about. They got, you know, the 5 o'clock. I don't know if it's 5 o'clock, 10 o'clock. They got the shadow. They got the little beards. They're, you know, they're not like the right stuff looking in astronauts, which I appreciate.
Like about 8 months stubble.
Yeah, exactly. And let's just talk a minute that I love the fact that they go to Venus and there's an atmosphere and a whole planet there and they can just get out and enjoy like an Earth-like environment and then find a person who's not really a person, but some kind of super being who is develop, you know, in the same accident that has made all these other kind of clairvoyant people on Earth. He's kind of got the ability to travel through time and space however he wants. And they just kind of, for some reason, he's susceptible to astronauts, like, you know, setting a trap and just getting him with a paralysis gun.
You know, one thing about this story, though, that bugged me a little bit, as much as I liked Children of Doom, is the fact that it begins with a specific narrative frame, but then after the first part, we completely lose sight of that narrative frame.
Yeah.
Which, you know, the first time I read this, I thought, wait a minute, did I miss something? Did we get a wrap up of the frame? But we never do. And the frame that I'm referring to, and this is on the very first page of this story, which is page 200 of this collection, where this young girl who has lost her sight, you know, because of the tragedy that happened on the on Earth, she's talking to her father. She says, "Come, sit by the fire, father. Tell me the story, father. Tell me again how the world ended." And so this begins, I was about to say Children of Doom, but part right. one of Children of Doom. Because at the very end of part one, the father who's telling the story reveals himself to be the one responsible for creating the doomsday machine, which got everything going, right? But then after that moment, I don't think that there's any mention of that narrative frame of the father telling his daughter this story about how the world became the way that it was. And in fact, by the time we get to the end of part three, the tail end of Children of Doom, there's no mention whatsoever. I mean, we do have a reference to a woman who has lost her sight. One may be tempted to think, oh, well, this is the young girl grown up now. But no, that doesn't make sense, narratively speaking. So this is someone else completely. So in other words, after part one, O'Shaughnessy, so to speak, completely jettisons his narrative frame.
Yeah, and it's I don't know. I agree with you. I thought reading this, because they had expectations after reading, like, oh, this is Alan Moore's, like, one of Alan Moore's favorite comics. Yeah. And then, like you said, the narrative kind of stops after that and then turns into a kind of a different story. And I thought, what, you know, it's almost like, oh, yeah, we got this good idea over here. So let's go in this direction. And they kind of, well, we got the good title and we got the child at the beginning. So let's just leave it all there.
Yeah. Then the focalization shifts to these two astronauts, right, who head off to Venus, find this world that in many ways they describe as a primitive Earth. And then they get a signal from Earth. Oh, all is not lost. There are people who are still alive. So then they decide to go back to Earth. And then that third part is, I mean, we have the astronauts, I guess. Well, no, I don't think we have even any reference to those three astronauts or two astronauts, but it's a couple of other characters and this woman who has lost her sight, but who has gained clairvoyant powers. And then you have this strange time traveling mutant, as he's described, that the two astronauts actually picked up on Venus and brought back. So the second and third parts are connected in some ways.
Right. Yeah, there's a thread.
Yeah. It's just it's a weird story. It's good.
But the other part is, if you look at page 223 and what the alien does, like, I don't know if we want a spoiler, but the alien does something to change the doomsday machine.
Right.
But
which takes us back to the first part.
Right. But the guy who is inventing the machine, if you look at that guy on page 223 and then look at 207 at the guy who's like, oh, I am the man who created the machine, they're not the same guy.
Doesn't look like it, no.
No. It's like this, so the visual reference isn't even the same.
Yeah, it's almost like, I don't know, the comedy version of Casino Royale, where you have several different directors who each takes the story into some kind of idiosyncratic, sometimes even strange place. And the entire thing, while entertaining in bits and pieces, doesn't hang that well together. But
or it's, to me, it seems kind of like a weird version of Exquisite Corpse, except for it's the same creators doing the same thing. It's almost like someone had part one, they're like, okay, follow this up, okay, I'll follow it up with part two, and then like, all right, well, here's part three, where do you want to go with it? And they're like, all right, well, we'll go here with it. And there's a thread. I mean, like, it's not like it doesn't follow, but it's kind of tenuous and strange.
Yeah, it's like the three sides of Denny O'Neill.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, I don't know, it's like he wrote one part when he was 18, one when he was 25, and one when he was
and the third when he was drunk.
Yeah. Exactly. He's like, you know what'd be good? Let's have some astronauts punching each other. All right.
This is a fun collection overall. I mean, and not just the story Children of the Doom, but
yeah, there's plenty of them that I liked.
Yeah, and you know, we've mentioned a few here and there. Before we move on to our next title, are there any other stories that really stood out to you in this collection? Either positively or negatively.
Yeah, I think we hit on most of them. You know, I like the one, this is going to sound weird, but the man's best friend one, about the aliens who decide not to destroy the Earth because they might, because then they'll get rid of all the dogs, and the dogs are actually the people, the beings on the Earth that are, everyone should learn from the dogs.
That's right. Yeah. And this one begins on page 100.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, like a dog saves this creature's life and, you know, people try to kill it, but because the people's first reaction, the dog's first reaction is the, you know, I want to get pet. I'm going to lick you. But the people's first reaction is like, let's get a gun and shoot that thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that reminds me of an earlier story. Oh, God, what's the one? I think it's the – oh, No Common Ground. Yeah, this is the one that begins on page 52. And it's a short three-pager. And this is one of the ones that Craig actually references in his introduction, in that on the one hand – on one hand, it seems quite timely, right? Because these aliens come to Earth or America, and the citizens, the humans, don't know what to make of the aliens.
Right.
And so they decide that a wall needs to be built between – them and the aliens. Sound familiar, listeners?
I don't think that's not based in reality, Craig.
Although it does have kind of a saccharine ending to it. The thing that causes both the humans to and the aliens to get along is the children.
Hey, the children. That's
children and dogs.
Children and dogs. Then there's that's the thing that kind of get me too. I will say that also struck me on page 194, the story called Never Again.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with the first, you know, beginning of the book, but it's got the Ditko art where it's kind of that twist ending where there's a society and there's a world and they have a nuclear holocaust. So they all, you know, kind of, you know, they're survivors, but they kind of have to revert to primitive means of survival. And then they kind of go through the world, and then time passes, and all those people die, and then it kind of comes to common day, and we find that person who was part of that civilization, and, you know, like, you know, the line, oh, poor fellow, you know, they're looking at the skeleton about this, you know, primitive, supposedly primitive being, that, you know, oh, poor fellow, and he never knew what real civilization was like. He wasn't advanced like we are today. Now you look around, Danny, and let your dad read his newspaper, and his newspaper is about Atoms for Peace. And it's like, you know, is this a story or could this happen? Did it? Could it? I love that ending.
Yeah. Yeah. The ending, I think, is definitely precious.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And there are a lot of these stories that have, to one degree or another, or to a greater or lesser degree, this kind of cheesiness factor to it. But I think that's one of the things that makes them so charming.
Oh, yeah.
Is that there's really no masking of the message and at times even the sentimentality that went into the narrative. And to a large degree, I can appreciate that, right? I mean, it may not be to my taste, but I can still enjoy it on its own terms.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree. It's a little bit blatant, I guess, maybe is a good way to say the message.
Yeah.
But yeah, I appreciated it too. Yeah. You know, there are a couple that, you know, there's a couple that end like, we are our own worst enemy. And then there's a couple that end like, the children will lead us.
Yeah.
But besides that.
And they do see some of them like that first thing, you know, we're our own worst enemy is not dissimilar from Walt Kelly's famous quote from Pogo. We have met the enemy and he is us.
Yeah, that definitely came to my mind a few times too. Like, I agree with what you're saying. I know you referenced it before, but yeah, it's Pogo did it better.
Yeah,
but you know, we all can't be Walt Kelly.
So, Sturge, do you want to move on to the second title that we're discussing this week?
Let's do it.
That's right. This is issue number 6 of Lovin' Rockets, volume 4. And for those who may have forgotten, this most recent volume of Lovin' Rockets actually started toward the end of 2016 when the Hernandez brothers, along with Fantagraphics, decided to discontinue the graphic novel annual version of Love and Rockets New Stories and to pick up again with a serial in the original magazine size format that we had with the first volume, because that's what we had with their first volume for the first 50 issues. Then both Jaime and Gilbert did their own things with different series like Penny Century or Luba Stories. But then Love and Rockets came back, I guess, as volume two in a serial fashion, but in comic book size. And then they ended that after, what was it, 20, 25 issues, and then came up with the annual graphic novel version, and we had that for, was it 7 or 8 volumes?
Eight.
And then after that, beginning in late 2016, in the fall, we had this fourth volume of Love and Rockets published serially in magazine format, which I absolutely love.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like the old days again. It's like it's like the original series. It's like that format. It's more frequent than quarterly. Although is it quarterly?
I think it's quarterly. Yeah. I remember that I interviewed Gilbert a few times, and the very first time I interviewed Gilbert, it was in I think early 2007, and we were at the tail end of that second volume of Love and Rockets.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he had mentioned at the time was the decision to go to comic book format instead of magazine size is that they felt that, or Fantagraphics felt that the issues would be more popular because they would fit into people's bags.
Yeah.
When they stored their comics. And Gilbert kind of laughed about that. And so that's why they went with that. But, you know, they made, I guess, a similar decision in going with a graphic novel format, thinking that that would not only perhaps sell better, but also be easier on the brothers. But it wasn't.
Right.
Because I think the last time Kunkka and I actually spoke with Jaime and Gilbert, which is at HeroesCon, if you recall, a couple of years ago at that panel, you know, they had mentioned that that format was becoming prohibitive.
Yeah. And like, I think I sat in that interview, and I think that their intention was that they wanted to kind of get more of a foothold in bookstores. And they figured if it was bookish with those new stories, that, you know, they'd be featured more prominently in bookstores, and it'd be more, you know, more likely to kind of catch on in that area. I think they were trying to, you know, I don't know, catch on to that kind of graphic novel crowd. But I don't know. Fantagraphics has lots of versions of their books out there. And I think at this point they have such a corpus that, you know, it can be collected in different ways and sold in different ways. So I'm kind of glad I'm going to admit this. I buy it in electronic form. I read it on Comixology electronically, and then I trade weight and buy hard copies so that I can put them with the rest of the books in my kind of Love and Rockets library.
Yeah, and the Love and Rockets library, I think that's its name, the Love and Rockets library, as opposed to the earlier collections, which were smaller or shorter. And I think they were called maybe the Love and Rockets collection. I can't remember.
Right.
They had a different name to it. And I have all of the volumes from the earlier collections.
Right.
Now I have all the volumes in this newest collection, which began several years ago when they started to repackage in thicker volumes and primarily collect by brother.
Yeah, right.
So Jaime has his volumes. Gilbert has his volumes.
Yeah, because originally they just kind of collected the comics in the form that the comics were. So they were
– well,
went back and forth for the most part.
Well, actually, the most of the collection were based on – when possible, longer storylines like Human Diastrophism. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Poison River. So those were larger storylines that may have included a few shorter pieces as well, but they were still, for the most part, brother centric. So either Jaime or Gilbert, there were maybe one or two collections that combined their works.
Right. I think they kind of ran into difficulty with the alternation. Just because it seems like, and they kind of own this too, and I'm not saying this as a knock, but Gilbert seems to put out three times the amount of stuff than Jaime does. And Jaime is much more meticulous, I think, and, you know, loath to create things, you know, or like let them out before he's ready for them to be let out. And not to say that Gilbert isn't, but I think Gilbert is, I don't know. He just seems to put out things at a much higher clip. Mm-hmm. He's got a lot more series.
He has much more going on than Love and Rockets. Whereas with Jaime, it seems to be about all Love and Rockets. I mean, he's done some non-Love and Rockets stuff here and or there.
Right.
But most of his efforts are put into Love and Rockets. And lately, these longer stories, right? Because we have coming out later this year, I think in March, the collection, or the graphic novel, if we want to call it that, that'll be titled Is This How You See Me?
Right.
And as we mentioned last week when we had the preview show, this was solicited, this will include this storyline, you know, the reunion storyline where Maggie, Hopi, and others from Hoppers, you know, the punk girls, get together for a reunion. And this is a story that began way back in an earlier volume of Love and Rockets New Stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know. I will also say that I kind of, after Love Bunglers, which the new book is the kind of the follow-up of for Love Bunglers in a way. Mm-hmm. It's kind of you know, chronological, and it looks more at like more like a punk reunion, like you've said before. Looking at those characters, but I haven't read every single Love and Rockets. I have jumped around a little bit in the new stories. There's a couple of those I haven't read, but I do pick up and read the things that without revisiting sometimes, which makes for interesting narrative experiences, especially with Jaime stuff, because Jaime kind of goes more chronologically, where it seems like Gilbert kind of circles back and everything gets revisited again. And the characters, you know, they age and then they kind of look back at what's happened to them before. And I don't know, I'm going to ask you this because I kind of go back and forth. Is there a brother you prefer to read the story? Not to say that they're both not good, but.
Right. It's interesting that you asked that because I just remembered that this was back in July of last year. I just looked it up, is when we discussed Love and Rockets Volume 4, Number 5. And mm-hmm. I did that show with Paul, and this question to some degree came up. I mean, which brother we tend to prefer. I hate to say this because I used to be a dedicated Gilbert fan.
Mm-hmm.
But it's gotten over the past several years to the point, as much as I love Gilbert's work, and I do, I really enjoy and appreciate what he's doing. The Fritz stuff got me at times kind of scratching my head, sometimes in a good way, sometimes in a what's he trying to do here way.
Right.
And I think since he's been focusing more on Fritz and the Fritz imitators, which can get really confusing.
And
if you don't know the world of Gilbert Hernandez, especially as it relates to the character Fritz, then you may not understand what I'm referring to here, but it can get extremely convoluted at times, especially since all the Fritz imitators tend to look alike. And so it's like, who is this Fritz imitator? And how is he different from this other Fritz imitator visually? Just maybe a little bit, but not enough, because I still get them mixed up. And I think I've come to enjoy Jaime's work more, especially as it relates to Maggie and Hopi. In fact, one of the things I really appreciated about the storyline, Is This How You See Me, is very similar to what happened in Love Bunglers, is mm-hmm. that we're back to Maggie and Hopi. I think specifically with Love Bunglers, of course, Maggie and Ray. Ray is one of my favorite characters that Jaime has created. But I really enjoy Is This How You See Me, that storyline, that long storyline, because of the reintroduction, really, of Hopi and the relationship with Maggie and the kind of things and adventures that they go through.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is not to say that I don't like or I don't appreciate Gilbert's work. It's just at times Gilbert, and purposefully so, I mean, he'll admit this, lets loose and goes over the top. Now, sometimes he goes over the top with non-Love and Rockets work that sometimes find its way into Love and Rockets with Blubber. And it's been, I can't remember when the last time we had an issue of Blubber. And I don't know if you've been reading all the issues of Blubber.
I've read a few. It's I know what you're talking about. It's
the closest to porno that Fantagraphics has gotten outside of their Eros imprint.
Yeah.
And there's that. But also, Gilbert goes over the top in other ways. For instance, in that book that came out, I guess, a couple years ago, Garden of Flesh.
Right, right.
Which I thought was interesting, that in many ways kind of works its way into his Love and Rockets world as right. well. And over the top with Fritz, the Fritz imitators, and also Fritz and Luba's family and their breast size, it seems the older Luba gets, the more unrealistically large her breast gets. And the same can be said of Fritz.
Right.
Now,
right.
Fritz's sister and Luba's half-sister, Petra, hers gets smaller. And at one point, and I think it's in this latest issue, number 6 of Love and Rockets, where we get Guadalupe,
right.
who is one of Luba's many daughters,
right.
who explains that, yeah, Petra's breasts are smaller as she's gotten older, and the same has happened for me. Because if you remember Guadalupe, when she, not was a kid, but when she became a young woman,
right.
she had breasts that were not dissimilar from her mother's.
Right, right.
Not over the top big like they are now with Luba and Fritz. So it's weird that if this is a genetic thing, and Gilbert has suggested in so many words when I've interviewed him that this is a genetic thing. If with Luba and her half-sister Fritz, as they get older, they grow bigger, with Guadalupe and Petra, they seem to get smaller as they get older. I don't know what to make of that, but...
Yeah, and I hear what you're saying, because I agree with you, because I mean, I remember, I think it was in the 90s when Birdland happened, when Gilbert made Eros comics, and... Then suddenly they ended up in, I think that's where Fritz first appeared. And then they ended up in the Love and Rockets comics. And I was like, oh, so that's a crossover. But yeah, I think that what you're talking about are kind of similar. I have kind of a similar experience. You know, I think the human diatrophism especially was kind of one of the first things I read that I was like, this is like a great story. And I love how it's put together and the whole Palomar. Like I loved Gilbert's kind of world building in the Palomar mm-hmm. in the early days. And, you know, and there's Heracleo and Carmen. Their love story was something that kind of hit me really early on in their work or in his work, especially in Gilbert's work. And, you know, now I think, that is kind of the difference, I guess, for me, too, is that Gilbert, I think both of them have created like very realized characters and have populated their worlds, which are different, you know, in terms of sensibility. But it seems to me that Gilbert's more like a shotgun.
Yeah.
He wants to cover lots of different things. And Jaime's more like focused, like he wants to follow like two or three characters in a particular narrative. And that's kind of the difference. I mean, that was the fun part of reading this for me, is that Guadalupe gets married to Steve. They kind of joke about it in the introduction that, you know, it's kind of like looking at the, you know, who's at the ceremony and who's at the kind of party afterward. You know, it's kind of like a who's who of who Gilbert drew. And he doesn't like, you know, not all of them speak and, you know, they're there and they're kind of just displayed. So there's a kind of fun part for me, like, oh, there's this character that I haven't seen in a while, and here's this one, and you know, and there's still like the ghosts of people from the past and past stories. So it's like rewarding if you've been a long time reading Love and Rockets fan, because there's lots of people that show up in this, and you know, and you kind of get those little shout outs. But the Jaime stuff is more like concentrated for me in a way.
Yeah, you're right. Now, getting to this specific issue, you mentioned the word ghost, and I'm glad mm-hmm. that you did, because I think it allows me at least the occasion to talk about not just Love and Rockets in a broad manner, which we've been doing, but to talk specifically about this issue. And in this issue, number 6 of volume 4 of Love and Rockets, we mm-hmm. have 5 stories from Gilbert, and Gilbert's stories are shorter, especially the one that's half a page or not even half a page, the very last one, Crybaby yeah. Killer. Jaime, on the other hand, has 3. So with Jaime, we have it doesn't have a title from what I could tell, but it's the next installment in the Princess Animus storyline.
Right.
And then we have actually not a Maggie, but a Hopi story.
A Hopi,
Billy,
yeah.
Be a Hero, which I was impressed by. I mean, I miss Maggie. She's my favorite character of all the Love and Rockets characters. But, right. You know, we have Hopi at least. And then probably the most fun story that Jaime has in this issue, Frank Lopez.
Yeah.
Because Frank Lopez is such a funny character. And this is the world of Frogmouth and her sister Tanta.
Right.
So those are the three stories that are rather long-ish compared to Gilbert's. And Gilbert's are Giving Up the Ghost, The Fruit of Patience, Honeymoon for Young Lovers, and You, Ghost of a Chance, and then the aforementioned Crybaby Killer. Mm-hmm. Now, two of the stories have ghost in the title.
Right.
One of the things that struck me, we have two literal ghosts that we see. There's the ghost of Guadalupe's first husband, who was much older than Guadalupe, Gato.
Right.
And so we see Gato as this ghostly presence in some panels following Guadalupe around and even talking with her.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is the ghost of Guadalupe's sister, Doralis.
Right.
You know, one of Luba's daughters, and she died years ago, or in the comic years ago, from cancer.
Right.
And she was known for, when she was a little girl, she was known for being rather eccentric. And then when she got older, she became a pop culture icon.
Right.
She had this, I don't know, variety show. I think maybe it was a kid show at the same time.
But right.
It was all over the place, very entertaining. And that's how she became famous. And then, of course, she died from cancer. And so that's a ghost that we see literally in some of the panels in these stories. I don't know if you made anything of this, and maybe I'm stretching things here a bit. But you mentioned earlier Palomar. I know that in past interviews I've had with Gilbert, he has said before that he kind of wants to leave Palomar behind and do other things.
Sure.
However, over the past couple of years, he's come back to Palomar.
Right.
I think it was in, I think, issue number 4 or 3, or maybe 4 and 3 of the Love and Rockets Volume 4 series, that we even get characters that go back to Palomar. So he is returning to Palomar, and it is strange now that even with these Fritz stories, and in this latest issue with the prominence of Guadalupe, and I think we see more of Guadalupe in issue number 6 than we have in a long time.
Yeah.
There's a link back to the Palomar days, you know, when he was doing the things like the human diastrophism,
right?
And An American in Palomar, I think, is another longer storyline that I think was quite impressive. And so it's almost as if these ghosts that we see in Gilbert's stories in issue number 6, you know, of Gato and of Doralis, are in many ways metaphors for the ghosts of Palomar that haunt not only Gilbert's comics, but maybe haunt Gilbert, that he feels that the days that he would create his narrative world based on Palomar, as much as he may like to leave them behind, they're coming back, and not in a negative way, to haunt him.
Yeah, and I can see that. I can see that for sure. I mean, it's, to me, what's interesting, you know, he does, like, he's done a return to Palomar, but they're not, I don't know, the sensibility of those are different, though. You know, it used to be Palomar was kind of like, at least to me, reading through them and kind of revisiting them over the years, kind of like a weird version of his, like, Marvel comics. You know, I always thought it was weird that, was it Cello? Is that her name?
The sheriff.
The sheriff. She lost her eye like Odin. Luba always carried around the hammer. And I was like, you know, one's Odin, one's Thor, like in a weird way. And it's like, almost like Palomar was kind of like Kirby's old gods place. Like Palomar is kind of like the old gods place, and the new stories are based in that, because to me it's like, I don't know, I think he, this is just me experiencing his comics, I think he just makes comics and then has a, like, he just wants to play with them. It's like a kid with Legos or something like that. Like, he's going to put them all together and he's going to mesh his universes how he wants to. And, you know, I appreciate it in a way because, you know, it all makes sense in a way. It's kind of weird also in a different way, but it's almost like his creative impulses kind of mesh with, like, his past characters. And he makes something different and new with them. And like some of it, like you say, like the ghost part is definitely like, I don't know, it's kind of like a rock band, you know, and Love and Rock, you know, there is a band called Love and Rockets that has nothing to do with this, but you know, they get talked about, but it's almost like, I think in a way, Gilbert probably, or both of them probably have to deal with the whole, like, well, I like what you're doing, but it's no human diastrophism, you know, or whatever, like, you know, and it's kind of like, in my mind, it's almost like you say, it's him wrestling with the ghosts of his past successes or his past stories, because there's a lot of people that I imagine are like, well, how about stories like that again? Like, you know, that was a really good story. And it's almost like a rock band. It's always like, you know, you had that one hit back in 73. Let's hear that one again, like for the 150th time.
Right.
And Gilbert's just kind of trying to make things fresh all the time and also kind of incorporate that. And I don't know, there's a wedding, and, you know, weddings to me are kind of like a collaboration. It's like a combination of, your past and your present in a lot of ways, because all the, you know, your relatives show up and whether you want them to or not. And, sometimes,
right.
But, you know, and it's like the ghosts, and he's got those characters, and there's people in here I haven't seen in years in my mind. Mm-hmm. You know, he hasn't done anything with Heraclio or Carmen since those really early stories.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, for those who may not know, Heraclio is actually Guadalupe's father.
Right.
When he had a brief fling with Luba that he had at least at first tried to keep from Carmen, but then Carmen discovered because
you can't
she's
keep
Carmen.
You can't keep things from Carmen.
Exactly. You know, another thing I appreciated about the Gilbert stories in this collection, you know, not only the ghost references, but also what I read as kind of a call ahead to what we can expect, I hope, later this year from Gilbert, because there is a mention at least two times, maybe three, of Fritz finding old scraps of her mother's, Maria, mm-hmm. and that Maria never did follow through with making a film, but now Fritz is going to. That, I think, anticipates the complete Maria M.
Yeah, I agree.
You remember, we got several years ago that first book of Maria M, and there was going to be a second. But now there's not going to be the second. There's going to be a complete Maria M. And both Gilbert and Gary Groth have told me as much. And just because doing a book two and then doing the complete collection is kind of cost prohibitive at this point. And I thought that Maria M., the complete Maria M., would have come out last year, because I think that was when it was originally scheduled. But I'm hoping that it comes out this year, because I really enjoyed what Gilbert was doing in kind of a metafictional way, mm-hmm. with Maria M. and then anchoring it in unique ways within his Love and Rockets world.
Yeah.
You know, and not only in terms of, you know, the overt link of Fritz, but in her mother Maria, but there were other things that were going on when the first Maria M. book came out that Gilbert was highlighting in Love and Rockets that I thought was very different.
Yeah. And I really love those series of books that kind of they kind of predated the Maria M. thing, where it was kind of like the Fritz movie career, the self-contained little, like Chance in Hell.
Novels? Yeah.
The graphic novels. That kind of Maria M was kind of, I think originally it was one of those, it was pitched as one of those, or it was in that series. I mean, it's definitely the same format.
A Fritz movie book. Yeah.
Yes. Like Maria M was kind of like kind of like her mother's biography as a
the
movie.
Troublemakers. Yeah. There's a whole series of titles where, mm-hmm. where he did that. Even one of his first ones, what was that Vertigo? No. It was the Dark Horse title. That series then was later collected. I think one could make the argument, and I think it is included, that Fritz is in that book, but it's also included is one of the films that Fritz has starred in.
Yeah, and to me that's kind of that's one of the joys of reading this series, is that if you read it for a long time, you know, it's kind of got its own continuity and its own things. And I love the fact that, you know, like one of the characters has a movie career, and Gilbert knows which movies they are, and he's repeated them, or he's referenced them throughout the years in the comics. And then he actually makes the stories. So you actually get to see the movie starring the character doing a thing that, you know, is interesting. And the new stories was kind of full of that, I think, too. There were a lot of like the Fritz movies. I think that instead of putting them in those self-contained graphic novels, and started putting those stories in the new stories. And it's kind of one of the things I appreciate in general about their characters is that they've created this world and they're not afraid to play around with it and be really playful, but they're also not afraid to kind of do the thing that mainstream comics won't do, which is like age their characters. You know, you go to that wedding and, you know, part of the fun for me is trying to figure out who's who, because now people have lost their hair. They've grown beards. They've, you know, their body shapes have changed. They're older, you know, some people fill out, some people thin up. I don't know what that is. Fill out, thin in, got skinnier. How's that? You know, and it's the same thing kind of for me too. Like I love that Hopi story on page 15, Billy Be a Hero, just because it's got that Hopi sensibility, except for now, like being a kind of wiseacre punk rock, you know, woman. She's like a mom with her partner, like harassing the little league players at the field because they won't let her kid play.
Who's still a smart ass.
Yeah. And I love that. I love that. You know, it, like translate, like how they're able to translate the characters across time and still kind of, you know, they retain their kind of interesting features as characters, but they're kind of in a different locale, a different context. And I really love that.
You know, I do as well. And I'm glad that you mentioned this Jaime story, Billy Be a Hero. As I mentioned earlier, I was really pleased that that Jaime brought Hopi back even after the storyline, Is This How You See Me?
Yeah.
At the exclusion of Maggie, because we have Maggie nowhere in this issue of Love and Rockets. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I absolutely love, they're my favorite of his, Jaime's Maggie and Hopi stories, especially Maggie.
Oh, yeah.
And I think his coming back to them, even after maybe leaving that relationship for a while, as he did with the Thai Girl story. Because mm-hmm. if you remember with the Thai Girl storyline, we get Maggie at the very beginning.
Right.
And then after that, boom, she's jettisoned.
Right.
She's nowhere to be found. And it becomes Penny Century and others who become the main characters and Angel as well. But I also really enjoy in Jaime's world that, you know, it's part of the Locas universe, mm-hmm. the Vivian or Frogmouth stories and now her sister Tanta.
Yeah.
I really like that. Vivian, I like for, well, let's say certain visual reasons, but also she is, and I have always, but also she's kind of an asshole type character.
Yeah, she's great. She's antagonistic to everyone.
Exactly. And she's endearing because of that attitude. And so I really enjoy her. And then her sister, Tanta, is like this nerdy loser who tries to be cool and you can't help but feel sorry for her. So I appreciate that storyline as we get here with the Frank Lopez piece. But I have to tell you, you know, earlier I was saying that with Gilbert, sometimes he seems to go over the top and to become a little excessive with the Fritz stories, where I think Jaime lets loose and at times not loses me, but doesn't have my attention as much as he does with his Loca stories is with Princess Animus. And we've had Princess Animus installments since way back in the new story annuals.
Mm-hmm.
So we had in, I think, the issue 4, which came out last year, mm-hmm. The beginning of last year, or maybe the tail end of 2017, of Love, in number 4 of volume 4 of Love and Rockets, our last Princess Animus installment. We didn't have one for issue number 5. Now in issue number 6, we return to that. I have to tell you that of all the storylines, whether it be Gilbert's or Jaime's, that have been a part of Love and Rockets over the past several years, reading this latest installment of Princess Animus, I felt the most lost. It's like, mm-hmm. okay, I've forgotten a lot of stuff, and maybe it's because it's been maybe a little over a year or about a year since we last had an installment of the Princess Animus storyline. But even before that, I'm not sure what to make of Princess Animus, because Princess Animus in many ways looks a lot like Penny Century.
Yeah.
And at any moment, I'm expecting there to be some kind of revelation, right? That actually Princess Animus is Penny Century, or a character that has a Penny Century-ish background in some way. I'm not sure how.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just don't. We don't even have the actual character Princess Animus in this installment in issue number 6, but it's a Princess Animus story because you have a couple of other characters who have been a part of this anima storyline. I don't know. It's strange, but it just strikes me as Jaime's way of letting loose.
Yeah.
That is somewhat similar to the ways that Gilbert lets loose.
Yeah. And I agree. I agree with you on that. I mean, I like them. They feel like, I forget what it was called, but in the very first issues of Love and Rockets, it wasn't the Maggie the Messenger stories, but there was another story about, like, it was a sci-fi story starring a young woman just having space adventures. And to me, you know, Animus, I agree with you. Like, I do not remember the context for this at all, but it's kind of got that feeling of, like Jaime's probably, in my mind, Jaime's like, what do I want to draw? I want to draw a Mobius looking comic sometimes. So like on page five, the last panel on that, there's like a character with like this elaborate headdress being seen from the back. And then you find out he's a robot with like a laser. And maybe it's not Mobius. Maybe that's like a Ditko robot. That's a Ditko looking guy to me, especially on the next page. But then it's got like a fun little kid comic. And then it's got, you know, like the Maggie looking woman on the motor scooter that flies. And then you kind of get all these weird aliens, and he's like, I'm going to draw some weird aliens, and I'm going to draw somebody that looks like Penny Century. And then like on page nine, there's like some worms that look kind of like Mike Mignola worms to me. Mm-hmm. And then that one long panel, you know, the third panel from the bottom, they're like, there's the Alice the Goon Century. And it's kind of like, to me, it's like you said, it's like him cutting loose. He's like, what do I want to draw? What can I do to hold this thing together and kind of do the fun things that I want to do, you know? And it ends with like Merlin.
Okay. Now the character that you were referencing earlier, the one that visually looks maybe a little bit like Maggie, mm-hmm. is the character Lumina. And
that's it, Lumina.
She seems to be the main protagonist in the Princess Animus storyline,
right,
at the expense of the princess.
Right.
Because things seem to be more about her. So here, you know, we get and she's the one who is driving that scooter-like vehicle at the very beginning,
mm-hmm.
Even though her head is covered. And then we get Katak, K-A-T-A-K, who is this alien that we saw in earlier installments of the Princess Anima storyline, someone who is rather misogynistic, who kind of betrayed Animus and Lumina. But still, I've kind of lost track of what's going on with the Princess Anima storyline. So it's one of those things that, you know, if Gilbert's going to cut loose, then maybe I shouldn't, as a reader, try to find narrative cohesion and go back to remind myself of the threads, is maybe just take each of these installments that appear every now and again on their own terms and just have fun.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I like about this book, too. It's like it's got serious aspects to it. And, you know, there's definitely, you know, emotional stakes for a lot of these stories. But they're fun at the same time. And, you know, there's like a playfulness to this that I don't know, maybe it's been there all along. But to me, I don't know, this issue in particular seems particularly playful for me, just for what's in it. And even that Frank Lopez story that you talked about, I mean, that's you know, I love those kinds of Jaime stories, those kind of like slice of life stories where you kind of look in on a person and, you know, kind of they have like a, I'm not even gonna call it an adventure. It's just kind of like an episode that happens, you know, it's like just a day in a life kind of thing. I don't know. He reminds me visually of, Spain Rodriguez had those, Fred Tute, I think his name was, stories about one of his friends. It's like one, and I think they're true life stories, but he was kind of like this really troubled person who I think ends up, he's self-destructive in a lot of ways, but he's also very, like, he presents as like a He-Man, utterly fun, life of the party guy, but he's tiny. He's like tiny but strong. And he's always like doing outlandish things for attention, but he's secretly troubled. And I don't know, visually, Frank Lopez reminds me a lot of him. But I don't know if that, I don't know what that brings to this. It's just, I'm inclined to like Frank Lopez, but I also like those Frogmouth stories and those Tonta stories that you're talking about. Those are, I like when Jaime goes into that area as well. I don't know. He's just, like you said, he's, I tend to gravitate more towards his stuff of late in my Love and Rockets reading. But you know, I don't know. He's just more concentrated for me. And I think there's something about that, that even when it's a character that I don't have a lot of remembrance of his background, you know, I get into those stories a lot quicker, and I don't know. I just seem to take more from them when I go, if that makes sense.
So you want to move on to the last title that we're going to be looking at this week?
Let's do it.
Yeah. In fact, I think we spent more time talking about the unknown anti-war comics and then Love and Rockets than I anticipated. But hey, that's you know, we get going and who knows? Who knows what's going to happen?
That's right.
But what we're going to discuss now are the first two issues of a Dark Horse and Berger Books release, LaGuardia. This is written by Nnedi Okorafo. Is that how you pronounce her name again? Okorafo. And illustrated by Tana Ford. And the latest issue, I think, comes out this week, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Comes out, yeah, this week. It's from Berger Books.
It's from Berger Books. Yeah. And I've mentioned this several times on the podcast. The thing that I think of in terms of Berger Books is that it started at around the same time as IDW's
Black Crown.
Black Crown label. And another connection between the two is that both Karen Berger and Shelley Bond had been editors over at Vertigo, you know, first Berger and then Bonds. And so both of these series have a Vertigo-esque feel. I have to say that of the two imprints, you know, one at Dark Horse, one at IDW, the one that has more resonance with me, and I think both do,
right,
both I enjoy, but the one that I seem to enjoy a little bit more are the Berger Books. This time around, I don't know, my appreciation of LaGuardia is somewhat tempered. And we can get into why that is. I came into LaGuardia knowing what I knew of it with high hopes and also with quite a bit of expectation.
Right.
And and that may have been some of my quote unquote problem in reading through and reacting to LaGuardia number one and two. I mean, I think it's an intriguing story though, and I absolutely love Ford's art, which I think is a highlight of this series.
Oh yeah. The art is, I love how detailed it is. I love all these crazy aliens that she gets to draw, and she definitely, like, the characters, you know, they have a lot of emotion and they're really interesting. Visually, it's very interesting too. It's yeah. I think for me, my response to this, it's hard not to think of that anti-war comics book in thinking about it, just because.
Now, remember, I anticipated this. I said, I'll come back to this thought about being socially conscious and political.
Exactly. Cause it's that it's kind of like the contemporary iteration of this.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things I brought up about the anti-war comics is kind of the thing that I think works against LaGuardia. Not that I didn't enjoy it, because I enjoy it. I want to see where it goes and I'm going to follow this. I mean, we have the first two issues and I mean, there's only two more to go. So it's like, I'm in it at this point, but it's just the presentation of it. It's decompressed in a way that I think I want to know more and have more to it.
Yeah, I agree. Now, for those who may not be familiar with LaGuardia, and we're not giving anything away here, but basically just laying out or describing the premise. Basically, what we have is a world where aliens have made contact with Earthlings, but they've done so in the area in Africa, right? Right. Specifically,
Nigeria.
And so our protagonist, whose name is Future, appropriately enough, is Nigerian-American. And when issue number one opens, the character Future is actually coming back into the United States through LaGuardia Airport. And LaGuardia is the location of the only, not only international, but galactic international airport in North America because of the aliens having made contact with Earthlings years before. There are several, not many, but several, I think about eight, they say at one point, if I remember correctly, intergalactic international airports around the world, but only one in North America, which is LaGuardia, and which is where the series gets its name. And so when Future goes through LaGuardia, she goes through customs, and she's given a hard time because of her hair, all those locks that flow almost all the way down to the floor, and the people search her there, and it's a little degrading. And so, I mean, this comic, at least the first two issues, seems to be all about the alien, right? And not just in terms of science fiction aliens, which we have in LaGuardia in these first two issues, but we also have this idea of the alien, in other words, non-American, right? And so there are all of these echoes, not just echoes, but direct references to Trump and his anti-immigration policies. And I think on the one hand, that's one of the reasons why I had high expectations for this, is I wanted to see how Okorafor handled very contemporary politics in the way that she does as a science fiction writer. I don't know if this is the case or not. You were framing this in terms of too much decompression and mm-hmm. wanting more context and maybe even exposition. I did too. I thought of this maybe not so much as a problem of decompression, which I agree with you. I do think that there may be an issue there with decompression. But I think maybe even the decompression may be linked to another phenomena, and I don't know how fair this is to Okorafo, and that is someone from one medium trying her hand or his hand in another medium and not mm-hmm. really knowing the ins and outs of how to write for that medium. And of course, you know, comics history, especially contemporary comics history, is filled with examples of, let's say, novelists or writers of prose in one form or another that decide that, you know, they want to write comics or they're asked to write comics. And at least in their initial attempts, it may be a little rocky at first.
Mm-hmm.
And I was getting the sense that maybe this is the experience that, or the basis of the experience I was having with LaGuardia, in that Okorafor, and maybe Okorafor, or Okorafor, I'm sorry, I can't mispronounce her name, has written comics before. I'm just not aware of it. But I just couldn't help in reading these first two issues of LaGuardia that maybe some of the sketchiness I was feeling, you know, whether it be from decompression or lack of mm-hmm. context or what have you, maybe a relatively new writer of comics just getting her sea legs.
Yeah, and I agree with you there. To my knowledge, I don't think she's written comics before. She's got a pretty good list of young adult literature and also stuff for adults or novels. She's mostly a novelist, as far as I can tell. And I feel like that too. This is a kind of a story that we're kind of halfway through it. And right now I feel like the setup is good and I like the use of contemporary issues. I mean, with the mistrust of aliens and why they're here, the travel ban that is going into place, which, you know, has a large part to do with the narrative so far, but we're only halfway through it. And I kind of don't know how things are playing out. And there's a lot of, premise, I think, so far, in a way. And to think about, like you were saying, the thing is relatively short in modern terms, a four issue series, most things go six, right? Or five or six.
At least five. Yeah.
Yeah. So four is more classic. That's an 80s limited series, a four issue comic. So it's a shorter work and we only have half of it. And like you said, it's so far it's all build up and I'm waiting for payoffs more so.
Yeah. And, you know, this really hit home with me when I got to issue number two, which just came out this week,
mm-hmm.
and or is coming out this week as we record this. And we have a mention of him, but we have no panel space devoted to, at least in the first issue, seem to be a major character, and that is Citizen. And we don't know yet, at least I don't, I can't recall exactly Citizen's relationship with Future. We know they're connected in some significant way. We don't know exactly how. Are they married? Are they lovers? Are they former lovers? We don't know yet. But Citizen makes no appearance in issue number two, which struck me as weird because he made up, if not half, then almost half of issue number one. There's still this mystery of what is inside Future's belly. She's pregnant, but what, you know, whose or what's child is this? You know, is it Citizen's? Is it something more alien, which after we got to the end or toward the end of issue number two seemed to be teasing in that direction? I mean, I don't know. And so you're right. For this to be a four-issue series, to have this many questions halfway through just strikes me as a little incomplete.
And there's some breadcrumbs in there. Like, that's the thing. I think that at some point, I don't know if she tells this to, like, she's talking about the hospital because something has happened.
Is this when she's talking to her grandmother?
Right. She's talking to her grandmother. And it's something about treating people that are, her parents. Yeah. Something has happened at this hospital in the past. There's been an event that a lot of people died, and her parents too. And they are, there's a memorial to them in the hospital, or she doesn't think it's enough of a memorial, or actually there's no memorial, I don't think. But it's the only hospital that treats aliens and humans, I think. And I think there's some mention of, I need to find that page, but she says something about hybrids or something like that. People that are part alien and part human, which when we see Citizen in that one issue, you're right. He's like half the narrative in the first issue. But I think when we first meet him, he's looking in a mirror. And where is that? I'm looking for it right now. But
in that first issue.
It's in the first issue. He's looking in a mirror, and he's got a green thing in his beard.
Yeah,
Looks like a plant.
Yeah, exactly. And he makes some comment, you know, I can deal with a gray hair every now and again, but this?
Right.
And so, again, it kind of leaves this question. I mean, you're right. There are some breadcrumbs. There is some narrative teasing that's going on. But I would think that by the time we get to the end of the first half of this four-issue series, we would have a little more of a clue as to what's going on. Like, so, for instance, in issue number two, we're introduced to a character named Jackie, right? In both of these issues, and I'm assuming that the next two issues will also have this, begin with kind of a character list of the main players, so to speak, in this particular issue. And so we see on one of the first pages, I guess the first page of issue number two, you know, a variety of characters, you know, Citizen being, or Future being one, but one character, Jackie. It's like, okay, who's Jackie? And at first I thought, well, maybe Jackie's the name of Future's grandmother, but no, this apparently is a different character. And we see Jackie within the context of other figures, aliens, whose names are Laundry, Payment, and Surveillance. Because as we learn, I think in issue one, these are the kind of names that aliens choose to take on because they're easy to remember.
Mm-hmm.
But what is Jackie's – I mean, is she harboring these? Is she the – like the Earth mother, so to speak? Not the biological mother, but someone who helps and cares for some of these aliens who have made the Earth their home. I don't know. And so are we going to see more of Jackie in issues number three and four? Because we see her for a very brief few pages toward the middle of this issue, or at least in the first half of issue number two, but then nothing after that. So, I mean, I don't know. Again, I come away from LaGuardia, issues number one and two, intrigued and hoping for the best and wanting this series to pull it off narrative wise. I just feel that it's a little too sketchy and not enough information is provided to give me a satisfying read that I kind of can wrap my brain about what the hell's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. Like to me, it just seems like you said, there's a lot of stuff going on and we don't have a lot of context for it. And I don't know, there's a part of me that appreciates that because it's kind of like like there's a river going by and I just dropped it and we're just going to go for the ride and see what happens. But at the same point, you know, I think that there needs to be some more answers, really, like you said, because there's things that were nebulous about, and there may be more check-ins with characters, like Citizen not being an issue too at all. I think that that is problematic, and just in terms of narrative, just because we're getting a lot of different people, and do we need the band to be this dramatically displayed? I don't know, but maybe the point of this is that the time we're in right now, there's definitely a travel ban, or I don't know, it's either unconstitutional or not, depending on the moment. But the issue of there being one of these things is a big deal. And so, I think, it's kind of like that wearing it on a sleeve thing with the Charlton comics, though. It's like, okay, so this is about the band in a lot of ways, but it's, using a sci-fi lens to look at it. Which I will say, one of the things that I think is interesting in our talk is that, I view this as a positive about the series, is that we've been talking about it so far and we haven't talked about race at all. Mm-hmm. And everyone in this comic is either African or American or African American, and
or an alien.
But they're all, as far as I can tell, they've all been people of color. And so that's, to me, a positive in that there's not a lot of, I always feel like there should be more narratives where people are represented, but the race thing isn't necessarily, it's kind of like Night of the Living Dead, the original movie, like he's an African-American guy, and that has some bearing in how it, the ending plays, but he's competent. He's the character. He just belongs in that world. And with comics especially, yeah. I think there tends to be this whitewashing of stories like this, or who gets to tell the story. And I appreciate this just being matter of fact, this is who it's about. And, it being Nigeria, has something to do with that. But, the fact that this story is about issues of representation, about who belongs, about who counts as a citizen, who counts
it's,
as a,
right. It's more about immigration and alienation than it is about race.
Yeah.
And in this way, it reminded me quite a bit of a book that actually Gene and I looked at last year around Valentine's Day. We did a episode where we looked at romance comics. And one of those texts that we looked at was T. Franklin and Jen Sedong's Bingo Love. And the thing that it surprised and impressed me most about Bingo Love is that because it dealt with LGBT issues, it's almost as if race, and this is another narrative where Black characters or African-American characters are central. Race wasn't so much of an issue or any issue, I think, at all in Bingo Love. It all came down to LGBT matters. Mm-hmm. And so the way that the narrative was constructed, it's not that it erased race, but it, in many ways, if this is the right way of saying it, kind of normalized race to where right. You didn't think about it as you were going through the narrative. And I felt something similar with LaGuardia. I mean, yeah, you can't help but notice that the protagonist and the other major characters are dark. They're African in terms of heritage. However, race is not so much of an issue here, except as it becomes linked to the immigrant, which in many ways color does, obviously.
Right.
I'm not saying that it doesn't. But I think that race is just not in the forefront of this narrative, which I agree with you, can be kind of a positive thing here, right? So we have something that is very timely. But again, coming back to the first book that we were discussing, the Unknown Anti-War comics, I think that
– where everyone's white.
Right. Well, but let's see if this makes sense, what I'm about to say. I talked earlier and we've discussed the fact that the anti-war message sometimes can become a little too overt, even sentimental, where the writers, whether it be Joe Gill or someone else – wears the message on its sleeve, right? And it becomes almost formulaic and predictable. To some degree, I think that that is a saving grace of those stories, because when it comes to LaGuardia, I felt that the attempt to some degree, kind of mask this, the message in a way, didn't work in ways that the wearing the message on its sleeve with the Charlton's anti-war stories did work in certain ways. And as I'm trying to describe this phenomena, I don't know if this is making sense or not. Am I making sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you are. I mean, and I don't know. I know it's a sensitive issue, and I just like personally that, you know, representation matters. And I think that there need to be lots of different stories featuring lots of different characters. And I'm glad that this comic is out there doing that work and also being political in a different way on an entirely different topic. That makes sense.
And for all of that, I applaud this title. I mean, that's what I was coming to expect.
Yeah. And I think it's that, but I also agree with you that there's a part of me that there's a separate issue of, you know, a writer that's not at home necessarily writing comics, having a little bit of a, you know, bump here and there in how the narrative is playing out. Like, for me, it's just pacing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I want to know more. I want to see other people check in, and, you know, and I hate to say like imposing a specific kind of narrative structure, because I don't necessarily agree with this all the time, but, you know, I think about like Marvel Comics in the 80s and, you know, Jim Shooter. Everyone hated Jim Shooter because he was like this taskmaster, horrible person, but he demanded that every character had to like give context, because every issue might be somebody's first issue, right? And so characters did stupid things like tell you their backstory when they introduced themselves, or, you know, like they gave context for themselves, or people had to check in. And that's the kind of thing that's missing in this narrative for me. Like, some major characters aren't necessarily all throughout the book, but, you know, I don't know what Citizen's role is going to be either. So that's one of the things that, so I, you know, in the end, I might be totally off base by this, but to me, it seems interesting. And this is my, I don't know if I'm going to spoil things, but this is my supposition that I'm guessing about. I'm going to think that perhaps something happens with the plants, that they become, I don't know, it's like pollen or something like that. We'll breathe it in, and somehow they get into our gizzards. And
yeah, and you're talking specifically, you're referring to the character who takes on the name Let Me Live.
Yeah, yeah, because there are not all the aliens are plant based, but some of them are, and Let Me Live is plant based. There's, you know, Future is pregnant with a baby. There's a part of me that thinks it's Citizens only because on the last panel of, or the last page of issue one, he's looking in a mirror. There's like this holographic photograph that looks like him, and Future, kind of, you know, lovingly embracing, you know, bumping their little heads together. And then he's kind of got this green thing wriggling in his beard that he pulls out. So there's some plants in him somewhere. And I'm assuming they, you know, they're consenting adults. They may have done something, and maybe there's plants in both of them. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious to see what the next two or the last two issues of this series is going to bring. And maybe if it'll clear up some of this stuff, but I tell you, at the very end of the first issue, we have a one-page note from Okorafor where she basically talks about the genesis of this story. She begins this piece by saying, I've been kicking this story around for over 6 years. And she describes the situation where back in 2009, she was coming to New York for an Octavia Butler symposium. And she had a bad, very negative experience at LaGuardia going through, you know, the TSA,
right,
where they searched her and she felt violated in the way that they did so, which I can understand. And this comes through very clearly in the first issue and even into the second, right? I mean, basing the very title of this short series on LaGuardia Airport is quite telling. But to me, it just seems that so far with these first two issues, the basis of what story we've gotten so far is this one negative experience she had back in 2009. And I can understand her wanting and needing to write about this in some creative manner. It's just, I'm wondering, is there going to be more to the story than this?
Right, right.
Yeah, and I hope there is. And again, I'm looking forward to issues 3 and then 4 to see how things pan out and, you know, what more we can learn about characters such as Citizen.
Yeah, and I'm also intrigued on the page prior to that. You know, there's some character design sketches, and there's one of Let Me Live, and it looks more like a Venus flytrap, and it says large, they're snake-like and powerful. So, you know, right now, Venus, Let Me Live is this tiny little sprout, and so seeing what it develops into is kind of interesting for me, too. Like, I don't know, like, I like the sci-fi stuff, I like the character stuff, I like the mystery stuff. I'm not in love with the pacing thus far, and I'd like a little bit more, information. But I don't know. Maybe that's I got enough to be intrigued. But like you said, I don't know. I don't know if I'm necessarily satisfied by things so far. But I got two issues, so I'm in to check out. Mm-hmm. In to check them out. I'm in to check. I don't know if that even made sense. I'm just putting words together, and hopefully they all sound good to y'all.
Well, we put a lot of words together on this episode of the Comics Alternative. We started off with the Unknown Anti-War Comics, a collection from IDW and Yo Books, edited by our good friend Craig Yo. After that, we looked at the Hernandez Brothers' Love and Rockets Volume 4, Issue Number 6, coming out from Fantagraphics, of course. And then we wrapped up with a look at one of the latest Berger Books contributions, and this is Issues Number 1 and 2 of LaGuardia, written by Nnedi Okorafor and art by Tana Ford.
Sounds good. That's what we talked about.
That's right. Really interesting stuff.
Yeah, and I think interesting, like, thematic, too. Like, I don't know. Like, I was wondering about this as a kind of weird eclectic mix of things, but kind of like some classic unknown stuff. Some, you know, Love and Rockets is kind of like a Usual Suspect kind
for
of thing.
For us, at least,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and in a classic series in a lot of ways, I think, worth checking out. And, yeah, like, then this kind of, I don't know, contemporary sci-fi book that kind of, I don't know. I like that being paired with the Unknown Anti-War comic. So, I don't know. I think that just worked together. I'm patting us on the back for
that's right. Yeah. I think it was an inadvertent pairing because, at least for me, maybe you thought of this, but I didn't. When we were discussing what to look at, mm-hmm. I didn't even think of pairing the anti-war comics and LaGuardia, but they did make a nice pairing. You're right.
Yeah. No, I didn't. That's too much. What's that called? Credit. I did not either. I was just like, this sounds interesting. Let's read that.
And if you want to find great titles like the one that we discussed on this week's episode, whether they be books by the Hernandez Brothers or collections from Craig Yo or brand new series like those that we can find from Berger Books, then definitely check out the website of our sponsor, which is Discount Comic Book Service. Go to dcbservice.com and you will find a whole slew of discounts on single issues, on bundles, and on very pricey books that you can get at not-so-pricey discounts. That's dcbservice.com. And after you do get your titles there, get in touch with us and let us know what you thought about this week's episode. Rather long episode, in fact. If you go to our website, comicsalternative.com, you'll find that you could leave us a voice message online via SpeakPipe. Or you can call us the old-fashioned way by picking up your phone and dialing 415-3-COMICS. That's 415-326-6427.
Or if you're inclined, you can email us at twoguys@comicsalternative.com. Or if you just want to email me, you can email me at sturge@comicsalternative.com.
and I'm Derek at ComicsAlternative.com. You can also reach us via social media. We have accounts on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram, Google+, Goodreads, Pinterest, YouTube, Slack, and Discord. You can subscribe to the podcast through Apple Podcasts. You can stream us on Stitcher. You can also find us on Spotify, on Anchor, on TuneIn, on iHeartRadio, and on Google Play Music, among many other platforms. But you can find every single one of our podcast episodes, as well as the reviews and comics-related commentary that we post on our blog, simply by going to our website, comicsalternative.com.
That's right. That's our one-stop shop for us, all of us.
That's right. And we will be back next week with additional reviews, so be sure to check back then. Until then, I'm Derek.
And I'm Sturge.
Take care.
Yasu.
What happened?